And welcome, everybody. Delighted and honored that you're here. And that the conversation comes up to the next level as we delve deeper and deeper into looking at this amazing Aramaic understanding and instruction set. You know, it's interesting that out of the Aramaic, literally thousands of religions have come. At least five of the world's major religions. Or when I say thousands, or thousands of sects of different religions have come. You know, the New Testament, Old Testament scholars or wisdom keepers were Aramaic. The Quran was written in Aramaic. The Zoroastrian scriptures were written in Aramaic. It's suspected that the Buddha spoke Aramaic. It's a language that conveys things that, in my awareness, no other language can convey. And so there are many things that need to be developed in the mind for the mind to be able to even start to conceive of what's being said in that language. And one of the things we've been talking about are these two filters, one in the frontal lobes of the brain called Ratma, over intentions, one over the back of the brain, perception, that keeps the mind keyed to love and opens a gateway for love to enter our human form. So when they said Rachma and Kubha, the two words that represent those filters or gateways, when they said perfect love casts out fear, they were saying, if these filters are set in your mind, then your mind cannot generate a construct based in fear. This can't happen. Like, you're free of it. And that becomes one of the most basic objectives of this work. Sadly, what's happened in most other cases is that people have taken the words of that language, translated it into the level of understanding of their own minds, and made up religions, or so-called religions. You know, we have, what, 32,000 plus sects now of so-called Christianity? And what's the most basic principle that has to happen for one to become a Christian? Well, or a true Muslim, or a true Buddhist, or a true Hindu. What has to happen? The mind that started out, you know, hold a newborn child, tap into the essence of the child, and you find love there. You'll notice most people look at life through hostility and fear. Those filters are what are active in them. So one has to be converted, and that's what we're looking to do this. We're looking to convert y'all, and we're looking to be converted. Not to a religion, though. Conversion is about converting back to a love-based mind, to a mind that literally is fueled by the active presence of love. And then one can enter into what's truly called prayer. Now, you'll notice that we live in a culture, this Greek-oriented culture, is kind of like, well, you know, prayer is putting your order into the cosmic gift catalog. Order the Creator around. Tell the Creator what the Creator should be doing for you today. When the word in Aramaic actually means to set a trap for love, for God. When you recognize the Creator is love, the word prayer in Aramaic, and you look back and they were pretty confused about it because they asked Yeshua, you know, tell us, teach us how to do it. They've been doing it all their lives, they thought, but obviously they must have recognized they weren't because they said, teach us how to do it. What does it mean to set a trap for God? Well, an analogy is the easiest way to understand. I have an antenna on the roof. If the antenna is properly aligned and oriented, it is a trap. It captures the signal from channel 4 or channel 2 or whatever it is, and I get to get a picture and sound. It captures that signal, feeds it into my TV, and that reflects as a picture into my room. So prayer in Aramaic is to be oriented and aligned, and that's what the instruction set is in what was called the Lord's Prayer. It's not a prayer at all, but it's a set of instructions for how to align and orient yourself so that the energy field in which you live, move, and have your being, you capture. You're a trap for it. And then you reflect it into the world. And what is that energy? It is the active presence of love. So another Vedic symbol, not normal to Western thought, is Kutcha. On toward the bottom, second last paragraph on page 35, by the way. And that is the Aramaic ancestry and to the Hebrew word kosher. And kosher means proper as delineated by the five books of Moses. Kutcha is a little broader, and it means proper as determined by interacting with the presence of love and bringing that expression of love into the world. And the English mind would call that functioning according to the will of God. And this specifically applies to man. So what are the rules? What are the laws? Remembering again that the Aramaic word law means how it works. What are the laws by which you become the space in which the active presence of love shows up, and you are then directed by that presence of love, because that's what was intended for us as humans. And then two Aramaic words, kata, K-H-A-T-A, and bisha, are rendered as sin and evil, respectively. However, the concepts cued by these words in the language of Yeshua are not normal to Western thought. Pardon me, each is an archery term. Sin, or kata, representing missing the target. So you're in the archery range, and you fire at the bullseye, and you miss the bullseye, and the scorekeeper yells, sin, you're off the mark. That's all the word means. If you fire at the target, and you miss the target altogether, then evil is the response, off target, totally and completely, where the arrow missed, where it went when it missed the target. Thus, in Aramaic, these words appear as not right as opposed to the normal meaning of positive wrongs. Increasingly, neural research, research into the mechanics of the mind, appears to indicate the fact that the human mind cannot utilize a right-wrong judgment approach. Apparently, the mind must follow at any given moment a right-not-right or a wrong-not-wrong evaluation system. That the mind's scanning system may be set to pick up what is right or to pick up what is wrong, but it cannot be set both ways at the same instant. So if one is, you know, brainwashed in wrong, you'll listen, and most of the language, even when heading for a wonderful target, most of the language is about what's wrong. You know, someone goes through an abusive relationship and they come out of that relationship, and if they have this mindset that we're talking about here, they'll say, yes, I'm ready to go into a new relationship, and here's what I want. I don't want someone who's going to abuse me again. I don't want someone who'll ever yell at me. I don't want someone who'll ever steal my money. I don't want someone who... And the mind is set for what's wrong. And when our words follow a path, because we're creators and our words are literal frequencies that create cymatic effects in our physiology, that is, organize the state of our physiology, then our words become pretty important. You listen to Yeshua in the Aramaic, and he says, words hold the power of life and death. So the Aramaic limitation of sin and evil to not right appear to reflect this newly discovered facet of the mind's mechanics. Off the mark, not right, rather than, oh, you're wrong. The person who's repeatedly told, and rather than being properly taught, and it's interesting in the word, in the Aramaic language, the word discipline comes from the word disciple, which means properly taught. If one is properly taught, then rather than focusing on what's not right, one is taught to language what is on target, what is correct. One of the things our granddaughter, who's now 5, has really, oh, how long has that been? Maybe the last 4 or 5 months, Jeannie? that Arya has been really clear about when either Jeannie or I or she languages something that is other than what we really want, she'll say, cancel that thought. And she shared with us, she's tried to introduce that idea at school, and the kids won't do it. So she says, well, when they say something like that, I just cancel it for them. So when we get the mind to its on-track state, and rather than positive wrongs, it's right, or, well, that's not right, but here's the replacement, what we're going to language about. Gee, your behavior, Arya, there was really not very acceptable. And here's what we want to do in the future. Here's how we treat each other. Here's how we behave when we fall out of line with the truth of what we want. And as all of the language is about the constructive aspect of life, not ignoring the destructive, but if the destructive comes along, being conscious, aware of it, and realizing that it's simply an energy to be removed, not an energy to be condemned, not an energy to be condemned over. You listen to how many parents, you watch how many parents, and the child does something that's quote-unquote, in their minds, wrong, and the conversation becomes about what's wrong with you and the condemnation, and now you're a positive, positive, not meaning positive, negative, but affirmative sinner. And how crazy is all of that when you realize how the mind works? So when you understand the mind's mechanics, you want to make sure that it's working with right, not right, if there's a not right, and then a correction. So the limited material from the Kaboris is felt to be of sufficient quantity to add materially to the understandings available in standard texts, particularly in relation to mind development and the mind maintenance instructions of Yeshua of Nazareth. The versing is in conformity with the King James Version. We sincerely hope and pray that these few lines hereafter presented will provide a wider understanding of and respect of the most complete truth ever made known on earth, the teachings of Yeshua of Nazareth. For the inevitable errors in the text, we sincerely apologize. And it's signed by the Onan Codex Foundation, 1974, the Kaboris Foundation, 2004, and Heartland Aramaic Mission, 1988 and 2014. And so that kind of gives us a basis of where we're going. And Miss Jeannie, before I step up to the next piece of the puzzle, is there anybody in the phone queue with a hand up? Anybody out there that has a thought for us? If you're on one of those stations where we can't see you, our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And if you call that number, you'll be listening to the show directly. And then if you have a question, just push 1, and we'll have a conversation. So, Ms. Jean, do we have anybody out there in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
It is all quiet on the home front.
Okay. Some of those who are listening, I know, have a copy of this text that is not numbered in the same way that this one is. And that would be if you've got it in a copy, if you've done Laws of Living, you've got it in a copy of your Laws of Living book. So we're going to move now to the space. If you look, there's a printed photograph of the Kaboris, of the colophon. So we're going to move in the printed text, it's page 37, or the bound text. In the Laws of Living text, I'm actually not sure what pages it is on. I don't have a copy of that here. But we're going to talk about the colophon. And so one of the more intriguing attributes of the Kaboris Codex is the colophon. A colophon is a tailpiece in old books, often ornamental, giving information on now placed in the, what, you know, normally today would be placed in the title page of a book, such as the author and the content and such. The word colophon derives from the late Latin term borrowed from the Greek colophon, meaning submit. We now call this page the preface or introduction. The colophon often contained a warning or foreboding to anyone who might think about altering the text to which it was attached. In the ancient scriptures, this type of colophonic material appears in the warnings at the beginning and end of the books of Revelation and so forth. Colophon to the Kabbalah's Codex contains 26 discernible lines and two or three indiscernible lines. And this is working from enhanced photography. I had the privilege of having that manuscript in my possession for about a year, in which time I went from one side of the country to the other as we were working with getting the text, high-resolution digital images made of the text. So I got to sleep with it under my bed for just about every night for a year. It was pretty cool. So normally a colophon would contain information about a scribe, the editor of a document, indications pointing to possible locations of the document's origins. Sometimes the colophon will contain blessings or quote-unquote cursings, depending on the importance of the document to the scribe and their community. So if you've got the printed text on page 38, you'll see that page. And it's pretty amazing. If you don't have the text or you want to take a look at the whole text of the Kabbalah, we do have, they're not the high-resolution images, but on our website, if you go to whyagain.org, whyagain.org/Kabbalah, K-H-A-B-U-R-I-S, you'll be able to access all 515 pages of the text. Be able to look at them, and it's an exercise to just be with the energy that comes off of the text. I know when I was traveling, you know, several times I was invited to present it to a group of people, and when you would open the text, people would gasp. They would feel the energy of that book. It was pretty cool. And what we know is, again, it goes back to the 10th century, the physical manuscript called the Kabbalah. We've had it carbon dated twice at the University of Arizona, which is kind of a primo carbon dating facility. And they've dated it twice at 1000 AD plus or minus 50 years. So that's the age of the physical vellum on which it's written. The introduction page to the manuscript tells us that it is a second century copy, or pardon me, a copy of a second century text. So it would make it a copy of the oldest known New Testament in Aramaic. And so page 39, we're going to look at some selected verses from Matthew. And the introduction here affirms that this is translated directly into English from the ancient Aramaic. It's interesting, there are some so-called scholars out there who say, oh, well, you know, the Aramaic texts were actually translated from the Greek. The Greeks, you know, of course, the Greeks wrote it down first. We all know that any Semitic person we know would write it down themselves. They'd hand it to the Greeks and let the Greeks write it. And then they'd copy it back into their own language. That would be a logical thing to do, right? Right, sure. Okay. So let's start looking at chapter 4, from 1 to 10. And what you'll see is that the key words are left in Aramaic in brackets. And then in the back of the text, there is a second century dictionary, or first century. There were 25 of the world's top Aramaists back in the 70s that, pardon me, did this translation work. And one of the main focuses of the work they did was to establish the first century, as well as they could, the first century meanings of the words. So the first, then Yeshua was drawn from, and the word min in Aramaic, which is a preposition meaning from or out of. So Yeshua was drawn from Ruka de Kudsha into an unprotected state. So what when we talk about Ruka to Kutch, remember we're talking about this feminine elemental force that undoes the effects of our errors and teaches us the truth. It's our guidance system. So what's being said is Yeshua was guided to go into what has been translated as an unprotected state. That is, if we look in the dictionary, it's an area outside of the protection of the city walls. Remember we talked about the camel going through the eye of the needle. And it isn't about a sewing needle. There was a gate. They were inhospitable people, but they were in dangerous territory. So at night they closed the city gates. But there was always one small gate through which a man could pass, and a camel could be kind of forced through, but you couldn't have a load of weapons on it and take it into the city and attack the city. You'd have to get the camel down on its knees, and you'd have to unload it, and you'd have to kind of guide it through the gate. So what is being spoken of here is that he's moved outside of the city walls, and that this can also refer to a condition where one is without mental or emotional protection. So I think we could render that a vulnerable state for what would be his stress from unrighteousness. And so, he's guided to move into this vulnerable state. And then the term unrighteousness, A-K-H-I-L-K, A-K-H, and I'm flipping back into the dictionary as we speak. A little bit of flipping back and forth here. Tapping into or stepping into a state where there's not protection available, or there may be those around who are not particularly supportive. And so he's drawn into, the way the Greeks translated it is the wilderness. So in essence, what they're speaking of here is that he's going to go into a state where he's ready to do some work. He's ready to open his field and do some inner work. And it's what it says is he fasted for 40 days and 40 nights. And I can relate to that very well from a very recent experience. Several days ago, I had a healing crisis opened up for me physiologically. And there was a spot, one of the places I've worked for many years. I've had a pretty tough birth experience as a kid, as a newborn, to the point where they told my father that I wasn't going to make it through the night. You better get down to the hospital if he wanted to see me alive at all. And so the other night I had a spot open up in my cranium that was just really, really intense, and moving into it, did some work on it, and let go of food, did some fasting, and went into a real detox, which meant a state of physiological discomfort. Sinuses draining. One of the things I had happened to me as a kid was, I can remember, so many times just screaming in pain from ear infections. And so for about 24 hours in my right ear, I was putting in food grade hydrogen peroxide to handle the detoxing in that ear of the infection that had opened up. So I assume from the symptoms that it was something right back to my early childhood. And then once that ear cleared up, my other ear started. So I spent the night putting peroxide drops in that ear and just had a general detoxification occur. And about the third day of it, Jeannie had made some dinner. I hadn't been eating very much, but Jeannie had made some dinner, and I was like, okay, I'm hungry. I'm ready to eat. And I was in this detox state, but about the fifth bite of food, it just totally shut down. That whole physical symptomatic release quit. And I expressed to Jeannie, I shouldn't have eaten. I should have just let this keep going. But whatever it was, 3 or 4 days was enough. I was ready for some relief from the symptoms of it. But that's just a step and a part of the healing process. And so what he offers, and so what moves when you open on that level is anything in you that doesn't belong in you. And so what are they saying happens to Yeshua after this 40 days and 40 nights? What they talk about is what came was temptation. What would temptation be? Well, anything that one has not dealt with within their own minds and bodies will start to move. And as they start to move, they will experience the energetic impact and the symptoms of release, which is exactly what I had going on for a period of about 3 days. So what we're hearing here is Yeshua basically is going into a detox. Tendency, what happens when you start to detox an old energetic pattern is that energetic pattern will tend to be used very readily to build the construct in your mind called perception. And the inclination to believe those perceptions based in hostility or fear can be pretty strong. And so it's spoken of as a force outside of him. And, you know, if you are the Son of God, if you are the Son of the Creator, Allah, say to these stones to become bread. And Yeshua responds, you know, it is written that not by bread alone does man have a perfect life, kathia, but by every word, i.e., milta. If you go to the opening words in the book of John where we're told it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh. Not what it says in Aramaic. It says, in the beginning was the mind energy, and the mind energy became flesh. And so what he's realizing is his own carbon-based memory is trying to suck him in, but he's able to respond with the awareness that, no, it's Miltha, the mind energy that issues from the Creator that I choose to take as the words I follow. So I'm going to stay attuned to, even though my mind is detoxing with something based in hostility or fear, I'm going to stay attuned to the active presence of love in me and the mind energy that comes from that. And that energy of the detox, he makes a choice different than falling into what's moving in him. That is the quote-unquote, as the first paragraph's book of unrighteousness, the energy that's less than love. He uses that, he consciously rides that wave through choice and will to move into a state of active love, to be this a state of guidance from Ruka Dikutcha. So you see that it moves into this, and here renders it as holiness, into where the mind has the inclination in a healing crisis to draw us into a narrowed state. It's interesting, in Aramaic, the word heaven can be properly translated as expansion. The kingdom of expansion is within, where when the mind is detoxing old energies, dropping into the desert or the unconscious, then the tendency to be can be to drawn into trusting that. And what this is implying here in chapter 4 or 5 is that he uses that energy to carry him into a more whole state, being into a higher state of awareness instead of being lost in carbon-based memory, being lost in the perceptual mind. And so this temptress, this tempting force, says to him, if you are the son of God, cast your nafsha and nafshak. If we look at that, is the word that represents our human beingness. And so he's in a state where he's being invited, kind of, you know, like, give the creator a little slap. Like, here, I'm going to fall, and you have to come and save me. You have to come and fix me. And so the quote here is about, you know, for it is written that the angels will have charge over you, and the hands they will take you, and your feet, they will not be touched by a stone. And Yeshua says, also it is written to not put your creator to the test. In other words, the idea is to trust the active presence of love in you rather than, and you know, if many humans have a power person dynamic where the authority in their lives is always testing them, whether it's a parental authority, an educator, it's like, you know, we're going to test you. And under stress, that can become a power person dynamic, and somebody's going to turn around and like, well, I'm going to test the creator. Do I really trust the creator, or am I going to test the creator? Yeshua's saying, I don't have any need here to test the creator. I already know. And once again, it says this unrighteous state of mind carries him to a high mountain and points to him everything of the world and all the things the world's got to offer. So what's the ego mind doing here? What's Satan? Remember in Aramaic, Satan means the resister, one who misleads. What Yeshua is saying is, what's most important in my life is to live in and as the active presence of love. And the mind says, ah, but you could have power. You could have money. Look at all the things the world can offer you. And, you know, the ego mind says, all these things I'll give to you if you fall prostrate and worship me. In other words, the ego is saying, I want to run your life for you. I want to take over where you put your time, intelligence, money, and energy. And we're going to make sure that you get all the stuff you can get, as though that has value. And Yeshua responds, get out of me, Satan, again, the resister, one who misleads. I'm going to yield up the part of my mind. I'm going to forgive as to the part of my mind that wants me to draw me into a lower state in order to produce some sort of benefit. There's nothing I'm interested in having if I have to step out of a state, if I have to step out of my natural state as love to get it. And so he's telling the resistor in himself, and it's interesting as I'm speaking this, I'm feeling the sensation in my ear that I was just talking about that went through the detox several days ago. It's the first time I felt it since. So there must be another level of that getting ready to move for me personally. So thank you, everybody, for the vitalizing support. It's a new level of energy moving for me. So Yeshua, when he's tempted, and tempted being there's some inclination to accept the world of hostility or fear in order to get an external result and yield up your connection to Rukka, yield up your connection to your source. And so Yeshua rejects that whole deceiver and repeats out of the scriptures, for it is written, you shall emulate or worship love. And that's it. That's what you're here to serve. So in essence, he's affirming that he's here to serve the presence of love in his life. He's not here to get stuff. He's not here to create false gods. And so that's the first set of passages, and as I said earlier, there are limited passages from the New Testament, and for me, that would be the lesson that would come out of that particular chapter, is to make sure that if you're going to follow guidance, that you're not following the guidance of the part of you that's in resistance. And how will you tell if the resistance is active in you? There'll be some form of hostility or fear attached to the perceptual constructs of your mind. And if that happens, there's where your forgiveness work is. It's like no interest in living there at all. Thank you very much. And then the next step, and we'll go up to the top of page 40, is heads into the Beatitudes. This is one of my favorite sections of this whole text to tap into the Aramaic Beatitudes. And so Matthew 5:1, when Yeshua saw the crowds, he ascended the mountain, and he was seated. His disciples drew near to him. Quibo, the Aramaic word. So they're tapping in energetically to him. Now, when one is speaking about a Sermon on the Mount, ascending, we're not talking about a physical hill. We're talking about stepping into a higher state of mind, a higher state of awareness. And the general attitude, at least as I've seen it and as I experienced it myself before I started to understand the Aramaic, around the Beatitudes, that it's this really powerful and sweet and nice and wonderful philosophy. But actually, it is not a philosophy. It is a set of instructions for how to achieve a result that is achievable. So in Aramaic, Yeshua delivered simple, practical teachings, and the first word in each of the Beatitudes is tuvehun, which is historically interpreted as a bestowed blessing. Big distinction here with the Aramaic. You know, it's like the Greek teachings are like, well, see, something is going to come along and bless you. But in Aramaic, actually, there's an element of earning a reward. There's an element of achieving a result that will be a reward to you. So each of the Beatitudes is an instruction set for how to achieve this reward. And what is the reward? Before each of the Beatitudes, the word is tuvehun. It's a three-part word. And in essence, what it says is the Creator implanted in your mind neural structures which will guide you when they're active. If they are inactive, you who follow these instructions will come into conscious possession of and be able to use this latent guidance system. And that guidance system is designed to make available thoughts and actions that will increase your happiness and well-being. So in essence, what Yeshua was saying 2,000 years ago is, hey, everybody, you have in you a creator-implanted neural structure that will guide you to your highest and best life. the guy down the block or your parent or the teacher or whatever told you, here's how you get to your highest and best life. Well, what you do is you just, you know, make sure you bully everybody out of the way and you become the king of the castle and you get all the money. Well, I've seen a lot of people in my 50 plus years of working with people that had a lot of money. But you know, I never saw too many of them that were very happy about it. So what Yeshua was saying here is that there is in you a guidance system, but there's some things you're going to have to do to bring it out of its latent or unconscious state and bring it into a conscious state. Now, classically, the Greek translation, the first beatitude is, blessed are the poor in spirit, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, you remember that in another passage, Yeshua talks about how you can deny him, but don't deny the spirit. Don't deny Ruach HaKodesh, the one that he's come to connect you to. So this is like one of the core pieces of his teaching. You have to engage in this guidance system that is put into you by the Creator. And here's the first beatitude that's telling you that what you want in regard to that guidance system is to be poor. It's like, duh. Hello, could you be much more, you know, like, that's at least 179 degrees out of phase with what he said. So the first step, and literally we're talking about, you know, remember that neurostructures are what, when active, create perception. Perception is a construct of the mind, and it's meant to guide us. It's meant to be, as we determined earlier, the light, the guidance for your earthly life. And what you want to do is make sure that the guide is always keyed to light instead of hostility or fear, which is darkness. So instead of counseling people to be poor in spirit and therefore getting some reward afterward, boy, has that ever put a lot of money in people's pockets. What he's saying is, you who have, in Aramaic, it's meskeni, and the word would more properly be translated as home. You who have a home, most people's home is in their perceptual minds, the constructs of their minds. Yeshua was saying, no, that's not where you want your home to be. You want your home to be in the active forces from the Creator. You want to be attuned to the energy field in which you live, move, and have your being. You want that to be your home rather than the constructs of your mind. If your mind goes off track and your home is there, it's going to be really hard to correct. And, you know, we're taught in this culture that the mind is the king and the end-all and the be-all. You know, what did Descartes say? You know, Descartes put Descartes before the horse. He said, I think, and therefore I am. As though thought was the prime level or the prime mover of the world. Thought is not the prime mover of the world. I be, remember when they said to the Creator, what's your name? I am. Is be, and from being comes thought. Now, what passes as thought in the mind is just recycled data from the past. We're looking to escape the recycled data from the past. We don't want your home to be in the fears, the hostilities, the goals, the wants, the desires of your mind. Because if it is, and there's error there, how are you going to correct your error if you're living in it? If that's like, you know, if you're like the fish in water, if that's all you see, how are you going to find correction? But if your home is in the eternal forces from the Creator, then you know that thought is just, and perception is just a construct. It's meant to guide you, but you're coming from a place that keeps the guidance system on track, rather than the danger of getting lost in the forces of the mind. So this first beatitude, speaking about you who have a home in Rukha, the active forces from the Creator, for yours is an heavenly estate. And remember that in Aramaic, a proper translation of the words kingdom of heaven, two aspects to it. One, it can be properly translated as the community of love, and two, the kingdom of expansion. So that implies that if you're in the eternal forces rather than in your head as your base, then you are in this space of connected love and always in a state of expansion. And when you look at what we now have seen from the newest Webb telescope, the expansion's got a long way to go. We've got, you know, a tremendous space for growth as human beings to comprehend what this creation is really about, to move beyond our own meddling little worlds, to move into the space where we're capable of bringing through what's really possible. And that's not going to come from the mind. That's going to come from that state of being. And part of doing this work is you distinguish the difference. You know when an energy comes, you know when an inclination comes that is your higher guidance as opposed to the mind. And you live in that higher guidance rather than in the mind. And so the result of that is yours will be Malkuta Dishmea, a heavenly estate. You will live in a state of guidance and expansion. So that's the first beatitude, and we're down to about the last 10 minutes. So before I push any further beyond that, I'm just going to open the space and see, Miss Jeannie, if we've got anybody else out there with a hand up in the phone queue or anything having a chat room.
There's no hand up, but a question in the chat room. How do you transition from punishing to offering a way that you have explained to children or others when punishing is all that you know?
Well, that means that you have, well, in a very similar way, what we've been talking about with this text is when you go from Greek to Aramaic, there are certain words that have similar meanings. And then there are words, like several of the words we've talked about, that we haven't even put into English in the text. They're in Aramaic, which indicates that you have to acquire a new understanding. So my offering would be, you're going to have to build some brain cells and develop a new understanding. And there's a dual process that you're going to have to engage in order to do that. One part of the process is going to be engaging in forgiveness. Remember that forgiveness in the context of the Aramaic language has nothing to do with I'm going to let you off the hook for what's happening inside of me. If I think you're to blame for what's happening inside of me, I'm now living in a lie in my mind. In order to actually develop a perceptual construct that tells me that you caused this in me, I have to dissociate from the real cause of what's happening in me, and I disable myself in the ability to change that. Forgiveness corrects that whole process, and I start undoing. Put the word undoing or removal in place of forgiveness. So engaging in the removal process of everything based in hostility or fear, and then build the brain cells for a new way of expression, a new movement. So literally, everything in this work, I mean, if you go back to day one, we've been doing this radio show now for, I think I heard Tim say the other day, 14 years, but I think we're actually in the 12th. Now I might be mistaken. Correct me if I'm in error. But if you go back to the first radio show 12 years ago and listened to every radio show since, and there have only been, you know, in the last X number of years, there have maybe been a total of 10 days where we haven't done a radio show. But if you went and listened to every show every day, 5 days a week for the last 12 years, I wouldn't address anything other than the question that was just asked. Everything would be related to how do I move from this state of being off the mark, to this state of being connected to an expanding awareness of myself as the presence of love, which will give me opportunities to forgive, to confront, to detoxify those things that might tempt me to fall into something that's less than love. I'm going to be given opportunities to utilize the tools, and I'm going to build new brain cells for how to move forward out of that state of love. I'm going to pay attention to, and I'm going to start changing my language. I'm going to, like, for instance, the thing I offered, you know, Aria, she says she's five, and she's offered kids at school this idea when they get into something negative of canceling a thought. She says, well, they just won't do it, so I cancel it for them. There are going to be a lot of thoughts to cancel. If your life has been about hostility, fear, punishment, being motivated, being driven by fear, being driven by punishment, being, you know, controlled through fear, it's a like a mega major piece of work and transformation. So my offering would be engaging in that work is what it's going to require. And again, you could go back into the archives. We've got literally 12 years of archives.
Actually, we did 13 years. The 31st of January, we started our 14th year.
Well, thank you, Dr. Tim. Okay. Wow,
yeah, we
two
started
years behind,
January
14.
January 31st, 2011.
Thank you, Dr. Tim, for saying that, because I've been saying 12 years now, probably for the last 2 years. I don't know. But anyway, okay, so we're at 14 years now. So every radio show you could listen to, and every radio show will answer that question, will give you another tool, another approach, another piece of work, another example, another interaction with someone who's in that same place doing, well, maybe not exactly the same details, but basically doing the same thing, maybe punishing themselves and coming out of that punishment, looking at their thought disorders. You know, sadly, what many people do is they use language to try to embody an experience that can only be embodied by direct experience, but they try to grab it through language. We're going to use language to describe a set of tools that, when used, will produce a result. The language itself won't produce a result, but the tools, when used, will produce the result. As I said earlier, we are literally looking to convert every mind, heart, and being on the planet. Not into a religion. We have no religion. There's no religion here to join. It just doesn't exist. But we are here to offer the opportunity to remove the hostility and fear-based energetic patterns that are in anyone's mind. We're here to hold the space for that and to facilitate that and to build the brain cells for having a mind that prompts one through integrity and the presence of love. And then understanding the healing process, you know, to me, that first passage that we read about Yeshua in the desert, what's the desert? The desert is a code word for the unconscious. The desert wasn't about a hot, sandy place. You know, if we listen to the story of Yeshua or of the Jews back, you know, several thousand years ago, we're told they got lost in this hot 35 square mile sandy place for 40 years. Which is pretty ridiculous when you think about a group of people who understand astronomy pretty well. How could that happen? Not even possible. But the desert is a code word for the unconscious. And what did they say had to happen to get out of the desert? They said the old generation had to die off. The root of the word generation is genari. It means cause. The causes in mind, based in hostility, have to go. And the engagement in the energetic patterns through language and thought have to move toward the active presence of love. When that occurs, a shift takes place. And that's what this work is about. So delighted and honored that you're here, and we'll step into the next level of the Beatitudes tomorrow. Thanks for joining.